Welcome, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. And it's the day after the Pennsylvania primary election. So you know what we do here on Studio 2.
It's simple.
All day politics today. We're going to be doing a political roundtable. We have our experts all together. We have a political strategist, a pollster, a political scholar. We're going to dig in today.
As we should, as the people expect, and we expect you to participate
exactly.
Today. We always get a lot of participation in our post-election shows. Today should be no different. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email us, studio2@whyy.org. We were on Instagram Live before the show,
yes,
as we always are.
A lot of feedback from people.
A lot of feedback
people
there.
People casted their ballot. They voted yesterday. They had thoughts on a lot of different things about the election. So we appreciate that. Again, studio2@whyy.org. And we're going to talk about November, but we're also going to talk about a lot of what, you know, Pennsylvania's primary means from yesterday. Get some thoughts and some takeaways.
Sure will. And we're going to start in-house here.
Yes.
Jumping into yesterday's primary election, winners, turnout, uncommitted vote. What was motivating people? I know someone who has the answer to several of those questions.
Mm-hmm.
WHYY political reporter Carmen Russell Sluchansky with us now in studio. Carmen, thanks for joining us. We know you're a busy guy.
No, it is a busy day, but thank you so much. I really am happy to be here.
And so, Carmen, right off the top, what are your big takeaways from last night?
Well, how about we start with some local elections?
Sure.
We have a couple of state rep races right here in the area that were really important. So probably one of the most closely watched was that of Kevin Boyle, 7-term state representative,
yeah,
Kevin Boyle, who lost his race. Now, this came a day after Larry Krasner, the Philly DA, rescinded an arrest warrant,
yeah,
for a restraining order that was actually issued initially because he allegedly violated a restraining order that it turned out did not exist, or protection order is what they were calling,
yeah,
it. So he was beat by Sean Dougherty.
Another big name in Pennsylvania politics.
Another big,
yeah,
name in
politics.
Yeah.
Last name.
Yeah. So that was when we were all watching. What else were you looking for yesterday, Carmen? What stood out to you?
Well, we have one other state rep race, which actually we're still watching, which is Amon Brown, who is now, it's too close to call. He is between him and progressive challenger Cass Green. So,
yeah,
we don't
this
know.
This is West Philadelphia, yeah.
Right, exactly, West Philadelphia.
Amon Brown, former candidate for mayor, was on the show. Last year.
He is just barely hanging on, but that's, mm-hmm, that race is still too close to call, right, Carmen?
Yep, they have not called it yet.
Wow. And then zooming out a little bit, looking at presidential, looking at turnout, I know you've written about the uncommitted movement here in Pennsylvania. We're parsing through all of that right now. Did anything jump out to you there?
Well, yeah. I mean, for one thing, turnout was low. It was like 17.5% here in Philadelphia. And that's really key when you want to look towards November, because a lot of the polls are telling us that Pennsylvania voters are not enthusiastic about the candidates. One poll I looked at, for example, has said that across the board, 17% of Pennsylvania voters are enthusiastic for the candidate that they are supporting. They're still supporting the candidate, right? But,
yeah,
they're not enthusiastic about it. So right now, people are not happy with our presidential candidates. And that seems to have borne out with the low turnout yesterday.
And so let's talk about uncommitted. There are some preliminary numbers on write-ins on the ballot. What can you tell us?
Yeah, so we know so far, it seems to be right about the number. Some results may still come in, about 58,000 write-in votes.
On now, the Democratic side.
On the Democratic side, yeah, no, exactly. So this is the, right now, uncommitted PA, they're already taking, they're taking credit, claiming a victory here because their target number was 40,000 write-ins, mm-hmm, for uncommitted. Now, the thing is, we don't know quite yet how many of those write-in, how many people actually wrote in uncommitted as opposed to, I don't know, Daffy Duck or,
yeah,
Bernie Sanders or something like that. So we don't entirely know yet, but it's still significant. That's a very large number of write-in votes. And so even if they're not writing in uncommitted, that is definitely a protest vote against, and ostensibly against Biden for various reasons, but particularly his role, the Washington's role in the Israel-Gaza conflict.
Right. And then on the Republican side, still pretty significant support here in Philly and in the collar counties for Nikki Haley, who's,
yeah,
not really running for president.
Yeah.
So it seems like it goes back to what you were talking about earlier. There is dissent in each party, and it showed up yesterday.
Yeah, 150,000 votes statewide for Haley. Actually, more than 150,000 with most precincts coming and reporting. Yeah, there's no way that people that 150,000 people didn't know that she wasn't on the ballot sure. anymore. Mm-hmm. So there's just no doubt that that is also a huge protest vote on the Republican side. And remember, so I looked a bit at this, went back and checked. Donald Trump got 91% of the primary vote back in 2020. And, you know, and so now he's, you know, looking at 83%, less mm-hmm. than 83%.
Certainly a drop.
Wow. Any final thoughts about yesterday?
Yeah, well, I mean, basically that. I think that it's what this all really tells me is that turnout in November, people getting, you know, Biden or Trump turning out their own people is going to really make the difference. Mm. Because remember, Biden beat Trump by only 80,000 votes in 2020. And so, you know, 150,000 votes here, you know, 50,000 votes there. I mean, it could easily swing the election one way or another.
And we'll all be watching you especially. That's Carmen Russell Sluchansky, WHYY's political reporter. Appreciate your time on this busy day.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And speaking of turning people out, getting in front of the voters,
yes.
What was Donald Trump doing?
Well, former President Donald Trump spoke exclusively on primary day with our news partner 6ABC. He spoke during the morning via satellite, and it was between right before he went into a Manhattan courtroom. The former president spoke about immigration. He spoke about the situation at the border, abortion, the economy, and he also spoke about the importance of Pennsylvania on his road to the White House.
Well, look, Pennsylvania is a very special place to me. And, you know, you have an oil industry, oil and gas, and frankly, it's being decimated by Biden. Those jobs are going away and your energy costs are going so high. And for some reason, they have not taken care of Pennsylvania. And we're leading very substantially in the polls there, and we're leading everywhere else.
I mean, Avi, his interview was just under 12 minutes. He made a lot of accusations against the Biden administration. He also dug in on his position on abortion. He also says he supports IVF. And one of the things he did do, which could get him in some trouble, he was very candid about the charges against him. He spoke about the case in Manhattan. He lashed out at Michael Cohen, one of the witnesses that are going to testify against him in that trial, and that could get him in some hot water with the judge in that Manhattan criminal case.
We'll talk more about this later in the show, I'm sure. But I should note, even though we're all desensitized to this at this point, that he also exaggerated and lied repeatedly in the interview. For instance, this is just one example. He claimed that Pennsylvania has the highest inflation in the country. In fact, if you look at the CPI, Consumer Price Index, Pennsylvania has perhaps the lowest inflation in the country. So just a straight factual error. And there were several of those in the interview. And I do think, even again, we're used to it. All we can do here is to continue to note that.
Exactly.
Moving now to a story that WHYY health reporter Nicole Leonard is working on. Really interesting story. She was talking with the folks over at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, who are investing a lot of money, $28 million, in artificial intelligence-driven weapons detection systems to make sure people are not bringing guns and knives into hospitals. This is amazing. So far, in the first 5 weeks that these machines have been up and running, 69 guns have been detected at the entrances to the hospital. Here is a quote from Joe Forte, the hospital's security director.
We're responding to violence in the hospital. And it's great to know that there's not going to be a gun up there or a knife when we're trying to calm somebody down.
Pretty fascinating development. This all comes, and Nicole reports this, that federal data shows there has been an increase in violence and threats against healthcare workers. So that's what they're responding to with these weapons detection screening systems.
Yeah, a lot of this was coming out during the pandemic.
Yeah.
A lot of nurses and other healthcare workers reported being attacked. We heard from the healthcare workers and the nurses unions talking about this. There's now a bipartisan act that would give healthcare workers the same legal protections against assault that commercial airline flight crews get. But folks should know that in Pennsylvania, assaulting a healthcare worker is a felony. But the problem is, a lot of times when nurses and other healthcare workers are attacked, they don't want to file charges. So
they don't
want to file for a variety of reasons. They're reluctant to file charges because maybe the person is having a psychological episode, for example. They don't want to file charges. And so there has to be a multi-pronged approach because the prosecution doesn't always work because if you don't file charges. And so this new security measure being put in hospitals is much needed. And so, you know, we're hopeful that our healthcare workers can remain safe and do their jobs.
Yeah, and look for Nicole's story on this. I think it's a pretty interesting topic.
For sure.
And she had another application of AI in the real world. And you said you hope it works. I hope it works too.
Yeah. Question. When does old age begin, Avi, for you?
Answer.
Yeah.
Whatever age I am right now.
Exactly. Well, a new study tried to answer that question. And not surprisingly, the longer we live, the later we perceive old age is starting, mm-hmm. right?
So it's never old.
Yeah, of course not. It's older than me.
It's a moving target,
yeah,
five, ten years beyond me. Yeah.
And they said, what number is old to you? 70, 80, 90? Researchers asked about 14,000 people who participated in the German aging survey, their perceptions about aging over a 25-year period, and found that it moved. You know, mm-hmm. Every 5 years, participants reported that old age started later as they themselves age. So people, as you get close to 60, 60 is the new 50, right? If you get closer to 70, 70 is the new 60. So yeah. It just sort of moves. And I'll tell you one thing. I think we do need to revisit what aging means because it's changed. 2-3 generations ago, it was being 50 or being 60 was totally different than it is now, thanks to medical technology, better, you know, exercise and all sorts of advancements.
Yeah, life expectancy changes.
Yeah.
Medical technology changes. Yeah. And this has a big impact, of course, on our economy, too, because when people consider themselves ready to retire, dictates what the job market looks like. It dictates sort of how people spend down their money and how they forecast their spending through their lives. So this
housing
is
availability, housing, and we talked about
we
that.
We did, yeah. So I agree with you. This is a bigger conversation. It's not just about what do you define as old. It's your actions, too. Mm-hmm. It's not just how you perceive old age. It's when you decide to transition in your life.
They did show that people who perceive themselves as younger than their actual age, they have some mental and physical benefits, less dementia, less depression. They probably exercise more. So, you know, age is just a number in many cases.
Email us, studio2@whyy.org. When does someone officially become old? Curious for your thoughts. Also curious how you pronounce the name of the diagonal street that runs through the heart of South Philadelphia and contains many of its most popular businesses and restaurants.
Pashyunk.
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 I don't know what to say now because I feel like I'm taking a position if I say the name of the avenue. There was a really funny, entertaining Inquirer article a couple days ago about conflicting interpretations of how to pronounce that very long P word of that very popular street that runs through South Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And there's no consensus, which is fascinating to me. Not even among the old timers in the neighborhood. And I am one of the new timers in the neighborhood, and I've always been confused by this.
Yeah, interesting. The original pronunciation was likely something like Pasayunk. That's
not
what I read.
Right. Not of the avenue, but of the word, the Native American, the Lenape word that it derives from, which means in the valley or in the valleys. So they took that word, put it on a street sign, but no one really, and then they did change how it was pronounced, but no one really has agreed on what the change is. Is it Pasayunk or Pashunk?
I have no idea. And I will say I've been a Pasayunk person, but now I'm going to rethink it.
I think it depends who you're talking to. If it's an out-of-towner, don't confuse them. Just say Pashyunk.
Yes.
If you're talking to your neighbor, maybe say Pashyunk.
Interesting.
Know your audience. And we know that you guys in our audience love politics. We're going to talk all about yesterday's primary election coming up on Studio 2. Email us right now, studio2@whyy.org. Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We have talked about the results of the Pennsylvania primary elections. We're going to dig in a little deeper, and then we're going to look ahead. Avi, if you didn't know, there's an election coming up in November.
Really?
I know. Biden and Trump will be the nominees for president. But what can we expect at the end of the year based on these primary results?
Of course, Pennsylvania, swing state, going to be a huge focus in the upcoming election. So there's lots of reasons to have a long, expansive conversation on this topic. And with us now to discuss and analyze the primary election results are our panel of experts. We have Vince Galko, Republican political strategist and senior vice president at Mercury Public Affairs. Vince, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
We also have Christopher Borick, professor of political science and director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion. Chris, great to have you.
Thanks, Avi.
And finally, we have Anthea Butler, MSNBC contributor and Geraldine R. Siegel professor in American Social Thought from the University of Pennsylvania. A pleasure to have you.
Thanks, Avi.
And before we get started, we'd like to hear from you, our listeners. What will be the most important issue for you when you head to the polls in November? Our phone lines are open right now. Call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
I just want to start with big picture takeaways from all three of you. So, Vince, you're looking at all of the results from yesterday. Your big takeaway is what?
I think it's DEFCON 1 for the Trump campaign in Pennsylvania. Governor Haley received almost 17% in a closed primary with virtually no campaign presence whatsoever. And I think if you look at the numbers, people are going to say, oh, this is the Philly suburbs that are revolting against President Trump. Yes, they did come out pretty, you know, strongly in favor of large numbers in favor of Governor Haley. But it's not just the Philadelphia suburbs. If you look at some of the counties around the state where President Trump and Republicans have historically done well, Bradford County, Lancaster County, Westmoreland County, Governor Haley got in the mid-teens. And Lancaster County, which many people will consider the heart and soul of the Republican Party of Pennsylvania, she received 20% of the vote. Mm. So that's pretty alarming for the Trump campaign.
Yeah, and do you have a sense right now of what's going to happen with those folks in November? It's impossible to prognosticate and be totally accurate. I understand that. But you say DEFCON 1. That makes me think that you think some of those folks are going Biden or staying home.
Right. I think, you know, the choice between, keep in mind, the Republican primary voter in Pennsylvania is much different than a general election voter. They're much more conservative, much more likely to vote, much more likely to vote on certain issues. So the fact that she received, you know, anywhere between 15 and 20% in some of these counties is alarming because this is the base of the base for the Republican Party. That being said, are they going to go vote for Joe Biden? Probably not. But will they stay home? Will they vote for a third party if one's on the ballot? Will they just skip over the presidential race? But more importantly, what is their enthusiasm to go volunteer, to donate $10? So there's definitely a more of an enthusiasm problem than anything else, I think, with some of these voters that President Trump needs to win them back.
Yeah, and so we want to continue your takeaways, Chris and Thea. Chris, we'll get your takeaway from last night.
Yeah, Jerry, a little bit of similar take as Vince had. But both presidential candidates, I think, as you look at the results, had some significant liabilities exposed. As Vince said, we look at President Trump's performance and relative to Nikki Haley in a race that has long since been over, particularly in some of the counties that we mentioned. You look at the suburban Philadelphia, of course, which is just an enormous driver of election outcomes in Pennsylvania. And having Haley pull almost a quarter of the votes in counties like Montgomery and Chester County is a warning sign. There's no other way around that for the Trump campaign. Of course, on the other side, President Biden had his own liabilities. He got 88% roughly of the vote. But Dean Phillips, someone who's, you know, not been running now for over a month, almost 2 months, and almost no name recognition, got about 7%, and write-ins are about 5% of the vote. I imagine most of those are uncommitted, or people wrote in uncommitted. In a state that is so close, always on the margin, these soft spots, if you will, for both Biden and Trump remain challenges. But the point is, both of them have challenges.
Yeah, and Thea, I want you to jump in here.
Yeah, I think I agree with both Vince. And I think also, here's the thing. I think for Trump, the problem becomes deeper. And the problem becomes deeper as long as he continues to have court cases. That's number one. Number two is to have Nikki Haley turn out so well. When he just came to Pennsylvania about a week and a half ago, that looks really bad. Because it means that nobody's paying attention to him, or those voters that voted for Nikki Haley were like really solid and just thought, we are going to send him a message. And the message is that we will not vote for him. Now, the question becomes, can Biden turn some of those voters? That remains a big issue. And I think we're going to see Biden here a lot, as we already have. The second part of this for Biden is that write-in votes and, you know, votes for the other candidate are really bad for him, because he needs to solidify everything. And I think personally, the biggest problem he has right now are the voters who are disenchanted with him because of the Israel situation in Gaza. That is going to be a big issue, especially with young voters and minority voters.
Yeah, because the turnout was so low, we don't. Yeah. There's a lot of people who have turned off.
Yeah, and what? And I want to go back to you, Christopher Bork. What do you make of turnout here? I mean, turnout is so tricky because there wasn't a lot of reason to turn out because of a competitive race. And that's going to change who turns out, right? Because a lot of people are turning out because the outcome is in question. That was not going to happen yesterday. So what do you make of turnout?
Yeah,
and
of course,
numbers are still coming in. And we can look at past elections. I know I've got numbers here. 1.2 million people voted for Biden in 2020. So far, about 923,000 this year. About 1 million voted for Trump in 2020 in the primary there. About 788,000 so far, 2024. What do you make of turnout, Christopher?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not a stellar turnout in the state. And that might be very explainable, as you mentioned. First of all, the top two billing tickets, if you will, the presidential race and the U.S. Senate race in Pennsylvania, were uncontested races, largely uncontested races. And so there wasn't a lot of drama that would bring in maybe more casual voters, as we like to call them. That just wasn't there. I mean, there were some competitive row office races, some competitive congressional races, primary races scattered throughout the Commonwealth, but there really wasn't a drive there. The other factor with that is there is a general sense of disappointment right now among the electorate with the choices. Especially at the presidential level, with both Donald Trump and Joe Biden having fairly low favorable ratings. A lot of voters don't like either of them. And that doesn't really create a situation with a lot of energy to show up. So I wasn't shocked. I'm, of course, disappointed that the primary turnout levels were as low as they were. And we'll get the final numbers in. But by all measures, it was a disappointing night for engagement in the race.
And Anthea, I wanted to follow up with that point that Chris had. Talk about the disenchanted voters, the folks who stayed home. Who are some of these people? Because both parties still need a coalition. What does that coalition look like on either side?
Yeah, I think there's broken coalitions on both sides. I think on the Trump side, the broken coalition is part of those voters who were, I would say, moderately Republican and leaning Republican or independents, who are just like, we're tired of all the drama. We're tired of the court cases. We're tired of the same words all the time. And he's slurring his words and everything. They're tired of that. That's number one. I think he doesn't have a sharp message this time around. There's no, what am I going to do? Right. Because I think if you got abortion and that's what you wanted, you got what you wanted. Right. So that's one part of this. I think on the Biden side, the bigger issue is the ongoing conflict in Israel and Gaza. That's number one. That is something that I hear a lot of young voters being very disenchanted with Trump about, excuse me, with Biden about. That's number one. I think that's one of the biggest things that's going to happen. The secondary thing is that, does anybody believe him when he says if he gets back into office that he will, you know, put abortion back in front of everything? And I think for women, that's going to be a big issue. African-American men are disenchanted with him, and they're very, you know, sort of skittish about whether or not they would vote for Biden again. And then I think the fourth group, which it seems like a weird group, but I think it's really important in this particular election, is for Biden and the issue of immigration. How is that being dealt with? And, you know, this is the issue that the Republicans really wanted to hammer, and that has not gotten them enough traction, obviously, with Trump. But I think with Biden, that could be a problem as well.
Could be a liability. We are talking post-election, post-primary takeaways with our panel here on Studio 2. Email us, studio2@whyy.org, with your comments. You can also give us a call, 888-477-9499. Just want to read in a couple comments here. Brian wanted to note that he's wary of the circumstances surrounding Kevin Boyle and Sean Daugherty. That's that state house race up in Northeast Philly. Brian notes Daugherty's ties to the police there, so he's not happy with how that played out, it seems. Deborah is watching that West Philly race between Amon Brown and Cass Green. Still too close to call. And she says she finds that interesting because she heard from a lot of local politicians backing Brown, and yet he is still in a dogfight there in West Philadelphia. Yeah. So thanks for those emails, folks. Vince Galko, Republican political strategist, want to bring you back in the conversation and talk about some statewide results that are not related to the presidential, particularly looking at that AG's race. On the Republican side, there was two main candidates, Dave Sunday and State Rep Craig Williams. Sunday was party endorsed and seems to have won quite easily. Yeah. What does that say about the electorate? Does it say anything, Vince?
Well, I think it's a good indicator that there is still an semblance of organization and strength within the Republican Party, both at the state level and the county. It has eroded in recent years, and you know, as a result of when you don't have a governor, when you don't have the presidency, it's very hard to run a party state organization. That being said, they were able to marshal their troops and get a message out for Dave Sunday. I know both gentlemen, both were great candidates. I thought Craig would run a little bit better. Craig Williams would run a little bit better. But surprisingly, even in the Philadelphia suburbs, you know, where they usually are parochial and will vote for their own, Craig only won Delaware County. He lost all the other suburban counties. So again, it's a sign of strength for the party organization. And you know, and just one note here, I would say it's unfortunate because we were earlier in the conversation, we were talking about low turnout and not high profile races. And these row office races are extremely important. Attorney General, Auditor General, Treasurer, they do not get enough attention. And you know, I've always said I would love to see them move to the odd number of years where there's not as many races and it would get more attention and people can focus on them more, because they do get lost because they're always in a presidential year or a high profile Senate race. And they, you know, kind of get dragged under depending on how the top of the ticket does. These such important races. So Dave Sunday showed some strength. On the Democratic side, you know, I think DePasquale had great name ID. That certainly helped him. I was surprised Jared Solomon, you know, his performance was lacking. He ran ads across the state where he was touting the fact that he got an F rating from the NRA and a 100% rating from Planned Parenthood. He was proud of it, which, you know, certainly appealing to the Democratic base in the primary makes sense. However, you know, he was running those commercials all over the state, and that message might not play as well in a place like, you know, Greensburg or Scranton as it might in some other parts of the state. So his messaging, I think, may have cost him in some parts of the state.
Yeah. And just for our listeners, I want to mention, so that what you're referring to there is the Democratic AG race. There were five candidates, very crowded field, and Eugene DePasquale, the former auditor general, won quite easily, 35%. Second was Jack Stolzheimer at 20%. And that was a pretty interesting result, right, Jerry?
That was a very interesting result with four candidates coming from southeastern Pennsylvania. I want to bring in a caller. We've asked folks to call in and tell us what their number one issue would be. And we have Phyllis on the line. You're on Studio 2. What's your comment? What's your big issue for the upcoming election?
Thanks. My big issue is women's rights and women's health care. And I hope that Rovember crushes the red.
All right. Pretty succinct and pretty straightforward. Thank you, Phyllis.
We appreciate that. Yeah, for sure.
Can I actually, on that AG's race, though, Chris Borick, on the Democratic side, sort of an interesting race because, as Cherry mentioned, four of the five candidates were from southeastern Pennsylvania. The winner was Eugene DePasquale, who did not win a single southeastern Pennsylvania county, which is usually not good for a Democratic candidate, considering how many Democrats are in this part of the state. But he cleans up in western Pennsylvania and then is now going to seemingly cruise to a victory here. Boy, geography seems to matter a lot sometimes in these races. Chris Borick, what do you make of all that?
It does, Avi, and Pennsylvania has clearly, you know, our regional loyalties, and that impact is often clear. And in this case, there was a dilution of the Southeast vote, with so many of the AG Democratic AG candidates residing in the Southeast, and Eugene DePasquale, who is, as Vince mentioned, has name recognition, winning Auditor General races twice in the state, has a Western Pennsylvania monopoly, if you will, among the candidates, and that's very, very important in terms of the breakout in a race that people don't know a ton about. As Vince mentioned, there was a lot of ads run by a few of the candidates, including Solomon, who spent quite a bit. That's one more piece of the puzzle, which is interesting. Often I get asked about, you know, the importance of money. DePasquale, if you look at the overall amount of money spent, amount of money that he took in, paled in comparison.
Yeah.
With a number of the other candidates. So it doesn't necessarily always equate money and fundraising to victory. And in Solomon's case, you know, finishing way down in the pack, despite some really big ad buys for this type of race.
And so, Andy, I want to get your takeaway. I mean, looking to November, DePasquale versus Sunday, your thoughts?
DePasquale.
Yeah.
I mean, approves. I think it just, I think it's pretty clear. I mean, if he's got the western part of the state locked up, then, you know, he just needs to pick up a few more things, a few more voters, and that's it. I don't see this being a tight race in November at all.
And we look to the Auditor General race now. It's going to be Tim DeFore versus Malcolm Kenyatta.
You know, I have a fondness for Malcolm, and I'm just going to say that up front, okay? Mm-hmm. I think
who's
it's
from
be
Philadelphia.
A tough,
who's from Philadelphia? Former state rep.
Former state rep. I think the problem here is going to be, can he get the rest of the state? Mm-hmm. I don't know. That is a big question, and it
he'll
depends
be
on what
an
happens.
Incumbent too.
Yeah, and that, I that's why I say I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. It First depends on how this race runs. It. I think he's going to have an uphill climb. Let me just put it like that.
A couple more comments before we go to break. Dorothy just wants to thank all the poll workers.
Thank you, poll workers.
And she says everything ran smoothly yesterday at her polling place. That's a wonderful sentiment. Thank you, Dorothy. And Glenn comments on Facebook, I received my mail-in ballot one day before the primary. Okay, that's something to monitor, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Thanks for those emails, Dorothy and Glenn. We've been talking with Vince Galko, Republican strategist and senior vice president at Mercury Public Affairs, Christopher Borick, professor of political science and director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion, and Anthea Butler, MSNBC contributor and Geraldine R. Siegel professor in American social thought from the University of Pennsylvania. This is our post-primary roundtable. If you want to join the conversation, email us, studio2@whyy.org. The phone lines are also open, 888-477-9499. We'll be right back after a short break right here on WHYY 90.9. You're listening to Studio 2.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. And we're going to continue our conversation right now about Pennsylvania politics with our post-primary roundtable. With us are Vince Galko, Republican political strategist, Christopher Borick, professor of political science and director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion, and Anthea Butler from the University of Pennsylvania. A lot more to talk about, Cherry.
A lot more to talk about. And so, Vince, I want to start this part of our conversation with the congressional district races. The one that everyone was talking about, there were several, but one was the first congressional district, Brian Fitzpatrick's race. He was able to win against his opponent. Can you talk about your takeaways from that race?
Sure. I think the fact that Congressman Fitzpatrick won what some would call a relatively competitive primary is a great indication for his strength heading into the fall. Obviously, the Fitzpatrick name is a beloved name in Bucks County. He and his brother have represented the county with honor and distinction and done a great job delivering for the district. The fact that he was able to show strength in the Republican primary shows that people are unified behind Fitzpatrick's candidacy and you know, heading into the general election, that's always been the strength of Bucks County Republicans to cross the aisle and to get those Democrats and independents to cross over and vote for them. So I feel that you know, his win yesterday is a very good harbinger of what's to come in November.
And piggybacking off of that, this was a state house race, Vince, that I had my eye on. Brian Cutler, who was once the House Speaker, the GOP House Speaker, had a pretty stiff challenge from the right in Lancaster County, you know, a very high-profile Republican at the state house level. It looks like he's going to hang on, too. It was a pretty close race. But again, sort of similar dynamics, a challenge from the right, not quite successful, although this one was certainly closer. Anything to take away from that Brian Cutler race?
Yeah, I find that interesting because it's, I mentioned earlier in our conversation that Governor Haley received 20% of the vote in Lancaster County, and that's the entire county, not this one specific district. But Lancaster County in a primary has traditionally been pretty conservative on many issues. Brian Cutler was Speaker of the House, a leader in the House for many years now. He gets blamed for a lot of, you know, the ills that conservatives don't like, the number one being the mail-in ballots. The leadership takes a lot of heat for that. So he's been under pressure now for the last 2 or 3 years because of the mail-in ballot issue, because of, you know, spending is always an issue with conservatives. So they had a target on him. They wanted to go after him. He, you know, survived, obviously, will continue to remain at his post, serving the people of Lancaster. But it's just very interesting to me that, you know, Republicans, conservatives came out strong for his opponent. But at the same time, in the same geographic area, not as many voted for President Trump. A good number of them voted for Governor Haley. So it's very interesting. Again, another warning sign for the Trump campaign. But I think whenever you're in leadership, especially when you're in leadership and you represent a conservative region, it's tough to you know, you have to govern, you have to compromise, but you also have to keep your base happy. And this is an indication of Representative Cutler being able to do that, but facing a stiff challenge in the primary.
Yeah. And Thea, I got to ask you about the 12th congressional district race. Summer Lee, very progressive,
yes,
was able to hold on to her seat, and she had faced a challenger.
She did. And, you know, I think that says something, A, about the campaign she ran, but also secondarily, what might be foretelling about not just her, but about the rest of the election cycle in Pennsylvania. If you can continue to push for a very liberal perspective and not do anything else, then I think Summer Lee will take some other people in. I'm also interested, and I know you all didn't ask me this, but I want to just mention this.
Put it in there.
Sean Daugherty's race, and that was an interesting race as well. And I think that might determine, you know, who has the House. And if we have to think about that for, you know, November and past that, that's going to also be an important part of Pennsylvania politics total.
Yeah, the Sean Daugherty, defeated Kevin Boyle handily in that district race, that state house race, yes.
A couple more comments to read in. Eddie says, I don't understand how anyone can vote for Trump with 4 indictments and all the trials and drama. Certainly some of those Haley voters must have agreed with Eddie. M says, I'm worried about the lack of enthusiasm for Biden and that a lot of voters will stay home on Election Day. How can his campaign make people understand that if they do, Trump will win? What's your response to M? Put on your political strategist hat, Aunt Thea Butler. How would you get folks who are not enthusiastic about Biden to turn out on Election Day if you were running his campaign?
Well, if I'm running his campaign, part of what I would do is I'd try to definitely solidify the women's vote. I think the caller, the person who said earlier, this was November, that's going to be a very big key because that's how you're going to draw out Democratic women, first of all. The secondary thing that you have to do is to make some more solid promises about what's going to happen with taxes, what's going to happen with inflation. You know, these are things that people have been concerned about. And the third thing that he could do, which, you know, I'm going to say that this is the most important thing, but unfortunately it's not going to happen, is that he has to stop giving out money for Israel-Gaza conflict. I mean, you know, I'm going to get a lot of flack for saying this, but I think that a lot of the people who are mad at Biden right now, this is not a personal opinion, this is, you know, what I see and what we can tell, is that the combination of looking at students across the country starting to build out tent cities and everything else does not bode well for the Biden campaign. And a lot of us who look at this as historians are thinking about the Democratic Convention in 1968.
Also in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And but the campaign of Biden might say, well, if we do that, what about those Haley voters? Maybe we'll lose our shot at persuading them. It's a difficult situation.
Absolutely a difficult situation. And I think one part of that difficult situation is that which group are you trying to get? What is going to help you the most? And where is that going to help you the most? It's first of all. So that's going to be a calculation for all the people working in the background trying to figure out what the numbers look like. That's number one. I think secondarily, you know, you can't look past the kind of funders like AIPAC and others who are going to be very concerned about what is happening, and they don't want that support withdrawn from Israel. So I think that's a big battleground. And it's interesting to me that the battleground might not be about America this time around.
Which is so rare.
Yeah.
It's usually domestic politics,
It'll be international politics, I think.
And Chris, I want you to weigh in here because I know Muhlenberg did a poll. Voters are stressed out. Tell us what you all found and tie that to what Anthea was talking about here when you're talking about motivating voters to get to the polls in November.
Yeah, Jerry, it's one of the most interesting findings of our most recent statewide public health poll. We do a poll of Pennsylvanians every spring on a variety of health matters. And we did a big chunk of this year's poll on mental health, which is an enormous public health challenge in the country right now. And we were looking at what Pennsylvanians say are the stressors in their lives. And we framed a number of questions for them on their personal situations, their work, their personal finances, and the other potential stressor are politics and current events. And what we found was politics and current events was the most common source of stress in terms of individuals saying it's a major source in their life. Over 40%, 43% of Pennsylvanians said that politics is a major source, compared to only about 20% for their individual's work or their personal finances, which we often think are major sources of stress. And Cherry, when you think about that, right, Pennsylvania, all Americans will be feeling the stress. It's part of our current moment, if you will, as a country. But Pennsylvania is particularly, I think, prone to feeling it. We're a swing state. We've got very competitive races in the Commonwealth. At, you know, of course, the presidential level, we'll have a major Senate race. We have lots of, as we were discussing, congressional races. The balance of the state legislature is incredibly close. Mm-hmm. And so we maybe more so than any place in the country are in the spotlight, in the heart, if you will, of this tension that's playing out. And
is there a fear here, though, that Pennsylvanians are going to tune out and not just tune it all out because they're so stressed out about it?
Yeah, I certainly think that there's conditions that might make voters step aside, right? They don't like the choices. They're overwhelmed by politics. They're feeling the lack of efficacy that they could make a difference. I think all those things are in place. We see from a polling perspective, issues like trust in the system. When trust breaks down, turnout often goes down or engagement goes down. So there's certainly a ripe conditions for a drop in turnout this fall that I think are certainly in place.
This is a bit of a sort of just throwing this out there because I don't know what to make of it type of question for you, Chris. There's one race that I look at and just kind of confused me, and that was the Democratic primary for treasurer. There were two candidates here, State Rep Ryan Bizzaro, party endorsed. His challenger, Erin McClelland, never held public office, and it looks like she's going to win roughly 55-45. Again, I looked at this and I just kind of had like a blank reaction, like, what? Any insight you can provide there, Chris Borick?
Yeah, that struck me too. Obvious. I was looking at the results. I said that one was not necessarily what I expected. You mentioned Representative Bizzaro was endorsed. Vince talked about in the Republican AG race, the endorsement of Sunday probably playing a positive role. Democrats, usually don't fall in line as well as Republicans do in terms of things like endorsements. And in this case, that certainly was borne out. They're both Western PA candidates.
Yeah.
This is interesting when you think about geographic for lots of people in the voter-rich eastern side and southeastern side of the state. I think there was limited name recognition. So how did Democrats make a decision on a race they don't know much about in terms of either the candidates themselves or even all that much what an auditor general treasurer does.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if other cues that we often use in voting, like gender, may have played a role, especially in a Democratic primary. Like you, Avi, I'm not all that sure.
Yeah, it's a puzzler.
And can we talk about this U.S. race for Senate? Bob Casey is going to go against Republican Dave McCormick in November. What stood out to me about this race, of the 944,000+ Republicans that voted, only 870,000 or so voted for McCormick. So everybody wasn't like pro McCormick here, even though he ran unopposed. Vince, I want to get your thoughts on that race. Bob Casey has done pretty well every time he's run. Does McCormick have any chance to unseat him?
Sure. Happy to talk about that real quick though. On the race we just mentioned, I think, yeah, you know, the greatest commodity any candidate can have in a Pennsylvania primary is the name of your county, which appears on the ballot. And there's no greater commodity than having Allegheny County under your name. And I think that really played a big factor. And certainly gender did too in the Democratic primary.
And Bizarro's not from Allegheny County. He's from Western PA,
correct,
but not that part.
Correct, yeah. Right. Correct. So his opponent was, and I think that was, you know, a very big part of it. In terms of the Senate race, Bob Casey, proven vote getter, probably one of the best political names in state history between himself and his father. He's got everything going for him right now. The one negative he has is that as an incumbent, someone who's, you know, a high profile Democrat, the insider's insider, you could say, there is no space between him and the president. He owns the president. President owns him. So I think Casey's fortunes rely on heavily on how President Biden's going to do in this state. Where McCormick, yes, he is a Republican. Yes, he's endorsed President Trump in the past, and I'm sure Democrats will make people aware of that. But he does have some open field running in front of him where he can he's not tied to party leadership, not tied to any votes as Casey has. I'll make an issue of that. And I think, you know, the greatest commercial Republicans have this year is that every time someone goes to a gas station, every time someone goes into a grocery store, every time a mom or dad decides, do we want to go into the city to have dinner this weekend or see a museum? Nope, because it's not that safe. Those are all the best commercials Republicans have heading into this year. And those items are going to help Dave McCormick, I think, on the entire ticket. McCormick's also going to have, a lot of resources behind him that prior Senate candidates didn't have. So I think that, McCormick doesn't need Trump to win the state, but he does need Trump to keep it, close here. And I think all indications are that it will be a very tight race here. So I think Dave McCormick will have a very good chance.
Before we go, rapid fire around the round table. Mm-hmm. Which campaign, Trump or Biden, is more enthusiastic or optimistic based on yesterday's results? Anthea Butler.
Biden.
You think Biden? How about you, Vince?
I think it's a draw. I'm not hedging my bet here, but I think both are disenfranchised. What I do think, though, yesterday is a good kick in the pants for the Trump campaign. So I would say Trump in the sense that they now know that they have a hill to climb here.
Wake up call.
With voters. So I would say Trump.
Chris Borick, which campaign you think is more optimistic based on yesterday's results?
Avi, I'll give the slightest nudge to Biden.
Yeah,
I think that
just because of that Haley result there.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, a lot to talk about,
and
the conversation is going to continue for several more months. You can believe that. I want to thank everybody: Vince Galko, Republican political strategist and senior vice president at Mercury Public Affairs. Vince, thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Christopher Bork, professor of political science and director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion. Chris, always a pleasure.
Thanks so much, Avi.
And Anthea Butler from the University of Pennsylvania, MSNBC contributor. Anthea, I know.
I'm holding it in.
You're holding it in. You don't have to say thank you. We thank you for the time today on Studio 2.
And that, friends, that's the end of our show. Thank you all who submitted emails, comments, and calls. We appreciate you. And I want to say thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Al Banks, our engineer. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Thanks so much for joining us. We will talk with you tomorrow.